Hello, listeners. Hi, it's your friendly GM Jason Keeley here, and you're only going to be hearing my voice for just a little bit now, because as the rest of our, some of the rest of our intrepid Hellbreakers are off preparing to head to Gen Con, I thought I'd record a brief little episode about the first chapter. We're at the end of the first chapter, and since I wrote it and just ran it, obviously, I thought I'd just give you all some insights into what I thought went well, what I thought could have gone a little bit better, what I was thinking during the running of it and compared to what was written, that kind of thing. So I hope you don't mind me just sort of, you know, riffing off the top of my head here. It's not going to be scripted or anything like that, and hopefully this makes a bunch of sense. Without much more ado than that, let's begin. I think I'm going to just sort of also ignore the kind of Breach Hill controversy that occurred with the whole Hellfire Crisis at the moment. The first chapter of this adventure path doesn't do anything in Breach Hill except basically leave it. So it's really not important what happened in Breach, not super important what happened in Breach Hill beforehand. If this is, say, coming off a Age of Ashes sort of campaign, great, your heroes did all the work of fighting off the Hell Knights, and still they won the day, right? And these particular characters don't have anything to do with Age of Ashes anyway, so it's all just sort of a moot point, really. But starting an adventure path, starting one of these long-term deals is always exciting and frightening at the same time, right? Because I know what's kind of going to come along, and the players have the player's guide to sort of, you know, kind of give an idea of what they want, but I have no idea what kind of characters they're going to make, if they're going to gel together, if getting them to the spot where the campaign begins is always just sort of like some kind of hand-waving, kind of, you know, sort of narrative trickery. But otherwise, it's just sort of like, yeah, you guys have to agree to all go there. I mean, it's the point of an adventure path is all the players have to basically be agreeing. Yes, this is what we're going to be doing. We're not going to, like, see the plot hook and then immediately abandon it, right? But still, you know, we had a goblin, a cambion, right? Nephilim with the sort of diabolic upbringing, a Strix, and a gnome and a halfling with, like, basically not a whole lot of, like, bog standard humans. So it's interesting to bring them in and be like, make sure that they understand this. Probably, like, oh, you know, Flack is a goblin. It might face a little bit of prejudice here and there, but for the most part, you know, we've set up Breach Hill being sort of welcoming, and especially after their sort of recent win against the Hell Knights and driving them off. But still, just sort of like giving them all the sort of little spotlight of how they arrive in Breach Hill and how they arrive at the tavern, and not really focusing on, like, why they join the Hellbreakers. Exactly how they join the Hellbreakers, right? They would just say, hey, you got some people. Some people are coming from far away, you know. Nalastri comes, Strix coming from Ravenel, basically, right? But Tad is a Breach Hill native, right? He's sort of seen what's going on here. So it's like an interesting sort of range of characters, experiences, to bring them in to this, get them introduced to the plot, and or at least the sort of opening push to what's going on, right? And I thought, again, you know, as I wrote this, I was thinking about, like, yes, it's a campaign, it's starting in a tavern where you meet a bunch of strangers who kind of meet. It's a little cliche, but also it felt that it could work in this sort of, oh, this is going to be a bit of a celebration, and not a, not just sort of like, you're just random people, right? You're already kind of there. They have the connection of being Hellbreakers. You're here and you've got a bit of a mission. And I wanted to introduce this character of an Eagle Knight who is kind of retiring, half retiring after they got, you know, pretty wounded in the battle. But still wanting to help the Hellbreakers. And so is being, they need to escort them a little bit across the country. And this would give the players the chance to sort of, you know, get to know each other at the beginning as this travel went, and get to sort of like maybe talk to each other about why they were Hellbreakers, and what, you know, what other people are up to, what the countryside is like here in Isgur. And so that's basically, yes, a very small sort of introductory of low stakes skill checks at the beginning, and then sort of moving out the next day when you when they all get the sort of like decree that comes down from Headvent that says, oh, look, every, you know, seditionists and traitors, there's a reward out there. Anybody who maybe is a self-proclaimed Hellbreaker should be arrested and brought to justice. Basically sort of, I don't know, countermanding a little bit sort of this win that the quote-unquote good guys have had. I guess I wouldn't say quote-unquote, but the actual good guys who had showing that the nation, the government of Isgur, is still very much in the pocket of Chillax, despite this sort of driving back, this repudiation of Chillaxian fascism, basically. Starting off with getting that information in a place where you're safe. Breachell's like, now we ain't dealing with that. F that, you know, basically. That's, we're not going to be turning people in. We are the people who are going to get turned in. But knowing that parts of Isgur, where they're going, this countryside of Isgur is going to be a little bit, maybe not as forward-thinking, maybe not as behind the revolution at this point, right? That's going to be up to showing them the hurdles that they're going to have to overcome. And, you know, and on this sort of journey, I wrote up basically two encounters to sort of help the PCs kind of like, begin to sort of test out what they can do and whatnot. The first one, when they enter this Draymoor, this little village called Draymoor, it's a bunch of Chillaxian loyalists, humans, who are just like, who are you doing? What do you want to get out of here? Just sort of the general kind of like, we don't like your cat around here types. And that went pretty much like, wrote this, and so it could be a combat encounter, it could be an intimidation / diplomacy encounter, right? Role playing encounter. And that went exactly how I thought it would, essentially, with this particular group. They're just sort of like, talk them down, just not so much sort of like, oh, friend, we're just passing through, but just like, yeah, what, who are you? we're just people. Why are you bothering us? And kind of just getting them to sort of back off before moving on in a way that I could have maybe stretched that role-playing out a little bit more for, like, episode length's sake, but it was as long as it needed to be, and so we just sort of, that one is a bit of a short episode in that sense. But they didn't want to fight, and I wasn't going to force the fight, right? Because I knew that, you know, as they sort of kept traveling, and maybe another day later, that they would be facing off against a sort of very early foreshadowing of the undead threat that are going to come up in later chapters. Spoiler. Isgard has a bit of an undead problem as well as a sort of a Hell Knight problem, right? It's contained in one area of the country, but it's still there. And so I wanted to sort of give this sort of like, oh, here's some weird zombie bats just flying in. That is a severe encounter, but we've got five players, and they handled that one also pretty well. My roles on that particular episode were terrible, so it didn't seem like much of a threat. And these big zombie bats do have a lot of hit points for level two creatures, as I sort of you saw me get a little, maybe heard me get a little taken aback by, like, what do I have? What the heck? One of these, I'll have so many. But that is basically essentially based on the zombie brute monster that does exist at level two that does have like 70 hit points. But then giving them a bit of flying, but not so much that it should be, again, since this is, again, a level, you know, for level one characters, the flying should not be putting the monsters completely out of the reach of a group of characters, which is why they're zombies. They're clumsy. They're going to fall down. They only have two actions per turn anyway because they're zombies. You know, it turns out to be that these things that might seem a bit scary in certain numbers are actually not that hard to sort of take out with a little bit of teamwork and a little bit of luck, I guess, some. And just luck in the sense of I had bad luck and they didn't necessarily need good luck in that sense. And that went, again, sort of pretty much how I expected it to go. A fight. Some people got a little wounded, but not as many did. And, you know, the fairy comes in and we get a little bit of that foreshadowing from the fairy operator that says, oh yeah, some undead maybe got happening around here. Maybe it's Tarbifon. It's not Tarbifon. But you know, they don't know that yet. And then we get to Sarengalo, finally, after a couple episodes of that, and, make it to the headquarters of the Hellbreakers and, meet the people who are going to be kind of like they're comrades in arms, right? It's always tricky to basically tell PCs, you already know what to do here, right? Your characters know what to do, so you just go to this place and say this particular catchphrase, and then to actually make them do that is always sort of like a weird thing about role-playing games sometimes, where you have to be like, yeah, your characters know what you do, but the players haven't been told yet. That could be done probably a different way than just sort of telling them. Maybe just sort of could have had some sort of, I don't know, handout or something that each of the players had as joining up Hellbreakers. Now that I think about that, that would be a pretty good sort of opening bit. It's like, like in some campaigns or some adventure paths, the opening bit is like, you get this piece of paper, this invitation to a party, and everyone has a sort of physical invitation, not a physical, but like, see it written down, and maybe it says some information you're telling the PCs, you're telling the players what the PCs know, in a way that's not just telling them, you're sort of letting them read it and then sort of extrapolate from there. I think that one maybe would have been a better piece of it. But that being said, it's also down to the fact that this is a secretive, covert organization. They wouldn't necessarily be writing all of this down to hand. They probably wrote it down and handed it to them, but like, you wouldn't be carrying it around. What if you got caught? What or searched, or your stuff stolen, and then some bad guys would already know where the headquarters was, and then the secret passphrase. Anyway, I've gone back and forth on that with team, just knowing that a lot of sort of Milani theme stuff happening here in the first couple bits, saying, getting to the headquarters, telling them that you're friends of Rose, and being like, oh yeah, that wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know what it means. And getting in and just sort of meeting everybody. I really had a good time writing these, coming up with these three NPCs who kind of are the lieutenants of the Hellbreakers League. Whereas I, Michelle, was the sort of main developer on this, and she came up with the sort of the Demetriuses, who we'll meet later, as the sort of leaders of the Hellbreakers. But I said, I get to come up with the sort of like some of their sort of second in command there. And so I threw in a Hobgoblin because I thought it'd be fun to show that while the Goblin Blood Wars of the past have ended, they were the cause, they were sort of possibly the fault of Hobgoblins. This Hobgoblin is trying to erase all of that, right? And then I wanted to use, I like using like essentially real names, maybe a little twist. I mean, I wrote this as someone, I wrote Marie, and then I sort of switched the vowels around, but then that's actually kind of like how you'd pronounce that would be Moira. Is what I learned, is an actual name, just even of itself, not just me changing it around. As in, and she's basically sort of like the face. She's a storyteller, basically kind of like, the fun one. One of the two fun ones, to sort of offset the sort of seriousness of Rokrag, the military-minded Hobgoblin. And Zara, who is the, I pictured them a little bit older than the sort of illustration that we got, but old halfling probably doesn't look that old. I don't know, look at Bilbo. They're probably not that old. They're not 111, but basically sort of another sort of like a more of a matronly, motherly, you look skinny, dear, you should eat this, all these pastries I have kind of figure. But they're fun. They're also like a baker bringing tasty treats. And presenting these three is that, they're going to have some things to do with the sort of the PCs later on, and as we end up seeing. But then eventually just sort of, chapter one, I just gotta say, after running it, it is chock full of stuff, right? Weirdly, it's more in it than you would think. It's got that sort of, that opening little bits, which does have two encounters, and then a tiny little warehouse encounter, and then you go attack a ship, and then you go attack another ship. It was just sort of like, a lot. And I realized too also that, I put two boat encounters in the first chapter. And it's this landlocked nation, which I thought was weird of me to do that. But I just didn't want to do necessarily we'll get to the sort of the river piracy. But I wanted it to be a little more interesting than just sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Highwaymen, right? Just sort of stand and deliver, give us your stuff. I wanted to put it on a boat just for funsies. It seemed like I could do the sort of, the boat's sinking, you got to get off it and collect the supplies, yada, yada, yada. But that's getting ahead of myself a little bit here. We go to the sort of Everbloom warehouse. Again, this is supposed to be a secret organization, but they do name their stuff pretty obviously, right? Everbloom is clearly Milani, but, you know, it's not necessarily, Milani is definitely not necessarily tied to the Hellbreakers, but, you know, if you knew, if you figured it, if you could figure it out, it's not that hard. This also kind of went as basically how I expected. Flak triggered the trap, the one hazard, to alert everybody. I threw in an extra loyalist in here just because we had five players. And, you know, they were, it's a lot of just like, that's always in the case. I sometimes have a little trouble with NPCs who I know are wrong. Like, I know these NPCs are wrong, but they think they're right. And I don't know necessarily how to like express that in my roleplay. So I'm like, no, this is the word strong. You come with that. What do you mean? Why should we give up to you? We're stronger than you. We're clearly, you know, we may even outnumber you. You should give up. No, I'll never give up. It becomes kind of a fun back and forth, but it always gets a little, for me, it's always, it feels a little unsatisfying. I should really probably brush up on my ability to present wrong ideas. with the conviction of the people who have them. But yeah, they rescued Gertrude, and realizing that, oh, the stuff that they were supposed to, Gertrude was supposed to have, didn't have. Oh, the revolution is going to need a little more provisioning, which is how we move on to this sort of river piracy section. This one, this part was, I think, happened a little bit differently than how I wrote it. Now, I wrote a bunch of stuff here that's basically like, hey, look, they have to stop a boat, basically, or get the attention of a boat, somehow get the supplies off this boat, right? And how do they stop a boat coming down the river? How do you get aboard the boat if it's moving? It's not going to be moving that fast. It's a river boat, but it's still fast enough that you can't just sort of like necessarily swim up to it. So it does become a sort of like you have to stop them, stand and deliver kind of thing. And I put a couple options written in there. Do you do it? Do you just swim up to it? Do you fake distress? Do you just sort of like point guns at them, or, you know, point crossbows at them and try to get them to sort of put the anchor down and prepare to be boarded? And so they did. They did the faking thing, which I was ready to do. But the way that they did it was weird. It was interesting. Not something I was expecting, to have Flak be shown as the bad guy, and that they, well, will you help us defeat this goblin and bring in and basically sort of like cause him to get essentially grabbed by the river, I wouldn't call them pirates, the Swabbies, aboard the Knight's Prize, the name of the boat. And it put them in an interesting position, because you're oh, thank you for saving us, you know, let's you can put this boat and put this one of the five characters, right? Put him in the brig. And he's going to be in the brig before this like starts off, right? Before any kind of like fighting happens, right? Like, that's putting yourself at a disadvantage almost, right? The group at a disadvantage. I think it went fine. Obviously they, you know, I sort of made sure that Flak could get out of the hold fairly easily. But to sort of offset that, they were like, we want to talk to the captain, which I don't have happening right until until they start attacking, that the captain takes a couple rounds to get up on deck, because the captain also has this sort of suit of armor with them, this animated suit of armor that helps protect them, right, and helps protect the boat. So the beginning part was just, here's a couple Swabbies who are like, oh, we'll fight you. And some of the other crew, of course, are just like, oh no, we're just sailors. We're not gonna get into this. We don't get paid enough to fight off boarders, right? And so it was like, Flak got sort of put down into the hold a little bit. And then I think it was Augustus who was saying basically, oh no, we'll, how can you repay us? Oh, they got the captain aboard. The captain came up on deck and was like, oh yes, of course, I'm the captain. And Augustus said, oh, you can, I forget how he put it exactly, but it wasn't like, do you need any more help? Yeah, we need more help. We'll take your boat. And the captain's like, what do you mean you'll take my boat? No, this is now a robbery. Oh no, this is a robbery. That I thought was like, okay, I can handle that. They're starting the fight with the captain here. The captain will be able to, I'll just say, I'll have them you know, do something to bring the animated armor up deck up on the deck before, and sort of merge these two fights together. Essentially, these fights are sort of meant to happen a little bit. They're meant to happen back to back, but they're not almost happen together. But again, there's five PCs. They can handle an additional two, you know, level zero creatures in the form of the swappies, alongside the captain and the suit of armor, which is the main threat. But then Tad one shots the captain with a gun, with his gun, with his inventor's gun. And I was like, oh, something like the way this is written is that the armor, which is difficult, you know, it, even though it is a second level creature, it is still a difficult, it's always a difficult fight to have something with hardness and a kind of a high AC at level one. But the intent here is that, oh, the captain goes down, then the armor just explodes. You don't have to fight it anymore. But they put the captain down right away, before the armor even came up on deck. And I didn't panic per se, but I know I had to sort of begin to adjust what was happening here. So captain falls, captain, even though the captain hadn't even acted in the initiative encounter, I gave him the basically enough of a reaction to be able to like activate the armor. And then his armor comes striding up on deck the next round, right? And it's a next initiative count. And begins sort of standing over the captain's dead body, or the captain's body. He was obviously dying, if not dead, to protect him, right? And then I was like, and then they kind of shot at him. I was like, oh, when they reduce it or break the armor or whatever, that's when I'll have it explode. And then they were having so much trouble doing any damage to it whatsoever. There was actually even, like, I think even one swabby left that they were also fighting at that point. They were just, like, not able to crack this hardness of the animated armor or get a critical. They used up their critical luck, criticaling the captain to death, right? So I decided, well, this has gone long enough. You know, we try to keep our episodes to about an hour. Let's just have it explode. So I gave them a little bit of a warning. Like, you know, Tab was like, well, what's going on? So if I, you know, when they ask, like, oh, man, we can't do any damage to things. Is there another way we can defeat this thing? Well, you notice that's actually kind of ticking like a bomb. I may have sort of overplayed that a little bit because they all immediately jump ship. Most of them immediately jump ship, which I was like, oh, no. They're going to have to swim back on the board ship to get the supplies. But they don't know that yet, so this is going to make the next bit, the sort of obstacle, not quite a chase, victory points sort of system, make it harder. A little harder for them. Oh, well. at that point, too, like, and we didn't have Nalastri in that fight because, you know, Rue couldn't make a couple of the sessions. And so Nalastri sort of appearing as this thing explodes, setting fire to the ship, sinking the ship, and beginning to sink the ship at any rate. And then sort of having to go like, oh, shoot, the supplies. Let's get back on board. Rescue supplies. People are sort of swimming off, and the way that it is written to is like, you can't leave the ship until you've gotten enough supplies. Once you start leaving the ship, you can't go back to it. And I realized that might have been a little bit of too restrictive. I sort of, as written, it sort of assumes everyone's on board the boat when the thing explodes. Unfortunate. But it, you know, again, it created some interesting tension and helping to sort of like, oh, can you put out some fire? People are getting burned. People are rescuing the things. Probably, you know, I had them sort of roll some stuff too that they probably didn't necessarily need to take a whole turn just getting to the ship. Although that did happen for one or two people. All the while, by the way, I was planning on, because, you know, this also being a podcast and the times we take to record it and how long it's going to take to get through 10 levels, I decided that the written encounter that happens right after you finish getting the supplies off the ship, which is against a couple of snakes, so these are sort of like river snakes that were created for the adventure, I was gonna just not do that, right? But the way things were going, I wanted to, they weren't helping the other crew get off board so much. They started doing it near the end, but I wanted to give them a sort of another opportunity to be heroes in this, to be the heroes that they are. And so once they were sort of mostly once the ship completely sank and they'd gotten off the supplies, which they did a great job getting all of those, having one of the sort of swabbies that they had knocked, not quite even defeated before the armor exploded, be on the shore as well. And not being hostile, but then being attacked by one of these snakes and getting bitten and poisoned, right? That gives them up to, and I think I only threw one of them at them, if I recall correctly. But that, and then just sort of, what are you going to do? Are you going to try to save this guy's life? He was fighting you just like 10 minutes ago. What are you going to do about it? And so that gave them sort of the opportunity to be like, oh, we got to stanch this guy's wounds and stop the poison, and then basically say, you know, hey, we're still taking your stuff, we're still taking the supplies, but at least you're still alive, you know, you can head into town and let people know that Hellbreakers aren't terrible criminals, you know, that kind of thing. So, I thought that was an interesting sort of twist in the way that it had originally been written, which is obviously just a sort of set of encounters, and we got to show the snake, which is fun. And so once they do it, they come back to Sarengello, hear that Rokrag has gotten himself in some sort of trouble. Most likely he hasn't reported back. He's gone off to sort of talk to somebody. And after they had a little, you know, night's rest, they head out to go see what happens. It's always kind of funny that the PCs always kind of have to do everything in Adventure Path, but also that is kind of the point of it, right? You need to have them be the big heroes, have them solve all the problems for the most part. You can sort of show the background. Yes, of course, there were other people also doing other sorts of bits of Light River piracy or what have you, stealing stuff, supplies for the revolution. And that all ends up being basically successful too. They don't have to, you know, they can feel like a part of a larger thing, but like the big main beats, like rescuing one of the lieutenants, does need to be up to them. And you know, they sort of, you know, Moira was like, I'm worried. Zara's like, take some food with you. Heading out to the Waterspout Inn, where a full sort of Chillaxian, I wouldn't call it a warship, but basically sort of a patrol ship, is there waiting. Clearly Rokrag is in a lot of trouble. This kind of was a bit of an open thing. Like this is a fight. This is an area, that I wanted to be pretty dynamic, but it could go wrong for PCs if they just kind of like charge in, because you've got the inn where there are some loyalists who have taken over, the camp of the soldiers and the sailors sort of behind it, and then a couple sailors also on board the ship. If you head straight for that camp from both ends, as written, it just sort of thinks that like, oh, you know, they're going to ignore a little bit of like noise coming from one or the other because they're used to rowdiness or what have you. But, you know, that's just to make sure the PCs don't get like completely overwhelmed in the first round. But, you know, you head straight, if you were to head straight for that middle of the camp, you could get sort of flanked by soldiers coming off the boat or the loyalists coming out of the inn, right? It becomes rough. They, I think, play the smart things, just were like, they didn't know what was going on exactly. They're just, you know, again, putting on airs of not being Hellbreakers, just sort of, we're here at the inn, what's going on? Seeing that the loyalists, you know, seeing some people who are like hanging out in the inn, not really seemingly inn patrons, guy behind the bar, kind of shifty, probably not the innkeeper, you know, getting some definitely bad vibes throughout. And then just basically like, I'm just wondering when is that going to be, while I'm running it, when is there going to be the tipping point between just sort of talking and trying to suss things out and then the loyalists getting suspicious or the PCs starting something? I think making the loyalists kind of, you know, obnoxious and just sort of, you know, definitely in the wrong, as sort of I've said before, but just being just generally sort of mean to the group, is it always enough to kind of push at least one PC into like, oh, forget about this, I'm going to draw my bow and shoot this guy in the head. Great, lovely. That's going to start some stuff, right? And because they started in the inn, like I sort of said, the sailors on the camp are used to the loyalists in the inn being all sort of noisy and whatnot. So there's a little bit of noise that happens in there. But I didn't want to give them complete freedom to just slaughter everybody in the inn and then, like, you know, sit there for another hour, right? I wanted to put a little pressure on them. So that's when they're sort of like looking out and seeing like, oh, they maybe something's about to happen. They're gonna maybe about to come in. That being the case of like, who's up here? You know, can we even find the innkeeper? What's going on a little bit? And noting that like, oh, these Marines outside, the sort of recruits, sailors outside are starting to sort of get, oh, no, sorry, I remember what happened. Sorry, I forgot what happened. They let one of them run. And I was like, oh, this guy's going to run? He's going to go get his friends who he knows are behind on the camp. Even though he ran out the front door, he's going to run around. So I gave them a chance to sort of continue the fight. That gave them a bit of a cushion there to, like, as the guy was running around. And then you hear some clamor of people getting alerted to what's going on. That did give them enough time to bar the inside doors of the inn, which is something I wasn't expecting. When I was writing this, I didn't expect, I thought maybe the police would just kind of like steamroll their way, you know, inside the inn, the camp, onto the boat, rescue Rokrag, right? They just started to hole up a little bit because it's strategically, it makes a lot of sense. You're inside, they got to get in to get you. They're not necessarily going to like, I thought if they turned it into a prolonged siege, I'd be like, oh, they'll probably, I thought the Chillaxians would just burn the inn down. They don't care. But they didn't get that far. And I just sort of like, you know, had them bash a door in. Meanwhile, you know, I may have also made a tiny bit of a mistake by saying that there are windows up on the second floor of the inn, something I didn't think about when I was writing this. There is a second floor of the inn where there are rooms and whatnot. And honestly, like realistically speaking, yeah, those rooms are going to have windows. They always do. At least that, you know, like, so, and then we're looking out and then like, you know, I think, someone just sort of, oh, throwing a bomb, one of the blight bombs that they got early on at one of the soldiers, just at the top, bam, boom. Okay. That's going to do some stuff. That's definitely going to kick some more things off. I thought that was fun, but I didn't want to give them full reign of just being able to like pick off everybody outside, essentially. So, you know, putting pressure on the door, that they had barricaded, giving them time to sort of strategically set themselves up inside the inn, I thought was nice, good for them. And then bam, that getting set off, and then just like some stuff went down, right? Inside the inn, there's a couple of the sailors who were doing some damage, right? Tad went down at one point, crit Flak or near the end of that fight as well, but then also sort of Nalastri jumping out of the window to take on the other sailors that sort of trying to flank the ones who were getting in, not really realizing that a couple more tougher sailors were actually going to come off the boat. In the end, I partially was rolling terrible. Nalastri did sort of hold her own in that instance, right? And it was all just sort of a split fight. Which would put some pressure on the one, our big healer, our sorceress healer, to make sure that no one died. And the sort of remit that they had earlier, so like, oh, you're going to go fight some people. Before even the river piracy, try not to kill too many people, because otherwise that's going to give Chelyax the ammunition to call Hellbreakers, you know, basically a bunch of terrorists. They didn't stick to that too much, especially Flak doesn't stick to that so much. He's just putting arrows into Longshank's heads. He doesn't care. They may or may not come back to bite them in the butt later on. Who knows? We'll see. But overall, like, as this sort of merged a couple encounters into one long encounter, it ended up being, though, you know, essentially because these are, what is it, two moderate encounters, essentially, between the camp and the boat, the soldiers already on the boat. Combining them up and sort of in a pacing it out a little bit does make it still on the hard side of moderate, I think. Especially, again, five PCs. I'm going to kind of smush encounters together when that happens often. You'll probably see that a little bit in the future as well. And then we get to the final encounter of the chapter. This is a severe encounter. They were pretty wounded. I gave them the opportunity, if they had to, sort of take a couple moments to sort of do some healing. They had a little bit of lay on of hands and one sort of heal that they could do, but, you know, a couple of them were pretty wounded, and I was a little worried about that. I didn't know how it was going to play out. But it is only sort of two creatures. This does sort of, you know, Captain Bane, level 3. It can get pretty tough, and you saw what happened. She cut down Nalastri as soon as Nalastri sort of got on the boat. It's something I did too. As the captain of the boat, Captain Bane has an ability to deal additional damage to people who were also on her boat. So I said, she's not leaving this boat. She'll send the devil out, this sort of insidiator devil, kind of an interrogation devil, out to sort of tanking, even though that is just a level one creature. He's not going to fare too well out there, but sending him out there to sort of distract everyone while she, thanks to being sort of this made a deal with the devil kind of individual, had some magic as well, so she could just chuck fire at people. I kind of came up with that at the last in the moment, saying that she basically has the ignition spell at will, and taking this illustration of Captain Bane in the book. I did not picture her having lit candles on her shoulders. It looks friggin' awesome. It's possible that because I named her Lamperia, that put light or something into either Michelle or the illustrator's head. But it looks great. And I took that as an inspiration to say, like, oh, that's how she casts ignition. She sort of draws the fire from her candles and blasts it away. I thought that was a fun little touch to add to this really awesome illustration. She's just got decked out in this heavy heavy, heavy coat, real reds and blacks. It's pretty good. If you don't have the pictures, if you don't have the art, you probably you see it in the episode if you watch the video. But she looks great. Stern again. I had some stuff thought out ahead of time what she might say to them, and I should have maybe written it down a little bit more. Again, I have a little trouble with villain monologuing sometimes unless I have something written down. Extemporizing the sort of baddies is not my forte, so I gotta consider that a little bit more. And the other thing I did with this particular encounter was to sort of disguise the devil very briefly, just to sort of say, like, when Lampyr steps out, she's got Rokrag at sword point, and there's a soldier behind, you know, another sailor behind her. Looked all pretty normal, right? Again, also, she, as we were going down the initiative track here, you know, with Ron having some technical difficulties, it did mean that he kind of had the delay, which let Lampyr kind of go before some other people. I was like, she's not going to kill Rokrag. I know that a sort of a quote-unquote coup de grace is not going to necessarily kill someone outright in at least the way I was doing it in Pathfinder 2nd Edition, but she'll just take an action to cut his throat because she's being attacked and she's ruthless, right? This is just a show that the Chillaxians, they don't care. They'll kill anybody. They got the information they wanted from him, or did they? Not really sure. At least probably in the captain's mind, if she could kill this guy, she could then sort of semi-demoralize these other guys. And if she can capture one of them, maybe they'll have the information that Rokrag didn't give up under his interrogation. But back to the devil. The devil's standing there, and then I was like, what kind of this? Oh, this devil can spit webs and stuff like that. And then that would be a thing that, like, this doesn't quite work with rules and the way the rules work, you know, because he's been changed shaped, been polymorphed into a human. He probably shouldn't be able to spit webs, but this devil has that ability. And I thought, so that would just be like, what's going on? What's happening? And then just sort of using the casting of Bane, the spell, just sort of also revealing the true form of the devil, I thought was a kind of a fun touch. Again, it doesn't really work. You probably should have to spend an action to change shape while casting the spell, two action spell. But, you know, for flavor, sometimes you just gotta throw the rules a little bit to the wind. It's not going to be like completely unbalancing. I maybe could have kept him on the boat too, and that would have forced some more people on the boat, and that could have gotten some more persistent strikes from Lampyria while against people on the boat. You know, again, I'm not the most tactically minded. Generally, I'll make those tactical mistakes all the time. And then, you know, they took her out. The sort of cutting, getting the last year down to, you know, down to zero and dying seemed to be the sort of impetus to be like, we got to do it. Like, the dice love to tell the story as much as the people love to tell the story. It seems to me that, like, a lot of times the dice will be like, oh, now's the time for a critical. Boom, here's a critical. Just pure luck generally. But it definitely made it a very climactic moment. And then that's where they also learned that there's some Hell Knight after them. Ooh, what's going to happen next? I know. But again, I think as everything went kind of 75% of it, 75-80% of it went about as how I expected it would go as I was writing it. I've run a lot of games in my life, and I've written a few adventures, and it's kind of, I try to think about when I'm writing it, what it'll be like to run it, right? And I try to sort of help GMs give them the information that they might need to understand what an NPC is doing, give them sort of options for when PCs do things that you don't expect them to do. But I can't think of everything PCs will think of. That's an infinite number of possibilities, and you can't write up all of them. But, you know, try to give the guidance as much as possible and try to sort of, like, think about, like, what's the most obvious thing, fear, obviously write that first, and then a couple sort of side things, like, oh, if they decide to do this, this happens, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think it went pretty well. I'm excited. This group is kind of nicely gelling together, I think, as a group of Hellbreakers. They're going to be the big heroes pretty much later on. We're going to see some more of them sort of getting to know the countryside a little bit better in the future, and perhaps getting to meet or at least hear about who's going to end up being the sort of big bad of this AP, which I won't spoil right here, because I'm hoping that you'll continue to listen to Intrepid Heroes and or watch us on the YouTube as well. I will continue to don the devil horns, and until our next episode, I'll see you in hell, breakers.